Good day, Thomas Jefferson Hour podcast listeners. Good to be with you again. This week we have a show of, we're finally catching up on mail. We never really catch up on mail, but we go through the motions and make a pretty good attempt this week.
We're out of character, and it begins with an account of my recent ascent of Mount Whitney, which has crippled me in about 7 or 8 different ways. And so,
yeah, but then we have that great letter from that guy in Northamptonshire. Shire.
Our fellow Stuart, isn't it, from England?
Yes, Stuart Webb, I believe.
And yes, he wrote a great letter full of praise, but also asking some interesting questions. So we talk about that this week. We talk about the Federalist, you know, the nomenclature. What's a Republican?
Yeah,
what's
that was, you know, I love those kind of questions. Very simple question. Would you please clarify what a Republican was during Jefferson's time and what a Federalist was during Jefferson's time?
And David, we got some really interesting mail following our program, Show Mr. Jefferson. That's the one where someone said, where would you take him today?
Yeah, it was kind of like a sucker punch. Would you do this show, Clay? Oh, yes, I would.
No shows interest me more than ones that create a then-now situation.
Yeah, me too.
What was life like then? What's the translation today? If he cared about that then, would he care about it now? If this is an issue to us, is there an analogous issue in the 18th and early 19th century? What would you want to take to Jefferson's Monticello? What would you want to bring from Jefferson's world back to ours? Those programs always fill me with delight, and I think they create real insights about who we are and where we're headed as a people.
And then we spend a little bit of time talking about, without getting into all of them, there's a number of special events that you, sir, are involved in, and people should go to jeffersonhour.com to find out more about that.
Yeah, the 2 winter encampments at Locksaw Lodge, the annual Lewis and Clark trip in the summer. And by the way, the Wendover Death March is a Sunday school stroll compared to climbing Mount Whitney. That was the hardest single physical moment of my life. And also the Steinbeck trip in March. So people should go to the website, Jefferson Hour. It's wonderfully maintained by a young Turk,
yes,
a close friend of yours and mine. And
yes, he is.
He's doing great things with it, and people can go find out all of these things. But I want to do the Shakespeare program that I did in Norfolk, all over this broad land. And so if you're interested, find me.
And you will know it's almost time to go to the show, because now is the time when David swallows hard and does the pitch,
And please do, sir.
Well, just as I always say, this show is listener-supported entirely. We get no corporate support. We are beholden to no one. We get no support from public radio. In fact, we pay public radio to put the show up so that you can hear it on the air. And because of that, we always need your help and your support. And I bring it up because it's the time of the year when people begin to consider their charitable contributions for the year. And if you are considering one, we would greatly appreciate it if you would think of the Thomas Jefferson Hour. It's very easy to do without going into all the details. Go to jeffersonhour.com, click on the donate button. Now, this is different than the 1776 Club because it is tax deductible, and there are several options for you to make there. And with my apologies for that request, I shall now say, let's go to the show.
Indeed. Thanks for listening, folks.
Good day, citizens, and welcome to the Thomas Jefferson Hour, your weekly conversation with or about President Thomas Jefferson. I'm your host, David Swenson, and seated across from me is the creator of the Thomas Jefferson Hour, Mr. Clay Jenkinson. Not only are you an author and an award-winning humanities scholar, sir, you are a mountain climber.
I'm a mountaineer now.
And welcome back.
I have climbed the highest peak in the contiguous states, the lower 48. My friend Russ Eagle, who is a Jefferson Hour listener and a 1776 Club member, he and I climbed Mount Whitney, not only the highest point in California, but the highest point in the lower 48 states, in early October of this year, and I'm happy to say we're both still alive.
I propose, sir, that we spend this week's show catching up on some mail, some questions sent specifically to you, if that would be all right.
I think when people learned that I was about to undertake this journey, they began to fret a little about this, and I think several letters attend to this very issue.
Yes, and that's why I began there. We got a letter from James Zoller. Says, my wife just mentioned to me that you will be climbing Mount Whitney soon. I've done the hike 3 times, and it is a wonderful experience. He gives you a bit of a warning.
Oh, good. What is that? It's too late now, but let's hear it.
He says, I'm sure you are well prepared, but keep in mind that winter-like conditions may be encountered, and thanks you for the radio show, and says to please be careful on your trip.
Well, Russ Eagle was well prepared. He had great new gear, and he had done some training, and he had done some reading, and he was about as ready for this as it is possible to be.
Well, he's kind of ready for anything, isn't he?
He's retired. He's a kept man. His wonderful wife allows him an unlimited Amazon.com budget.
Geez.
He has a man cave, but he doesn't devote it to hockey or to beer. He devotes it to reading. And he is always prepared for whatever he does. And, of course, I was unprepared. I came as unprepared as it is possible to come. I brought a pack, but it was heavy. I had more in it than I should have had. I showed up, let's put it that way. And so we started out in a kind of a yin and yang mode. Russ, as ready as it's possible to be, me really just turning up because there was no way to weasel out of it. And off we went, and we climbed, about 12 hours over 2 days. We climbed 8,000 vertical feet, and climbing Mount Whitney, which is 14,500 feet or so, is like going to the Empire State Building and climbing it all day long. And when you get to the top floor, you're whisked down and you start again. And when you get to the top floor, you're whisked down and you start again. When you finish the hike, David, you can't believe that you did it. You know, coming down is the reality check, because as you come down, you realize you're barely able to maintain your balance coming down. You're being kind of thrown off the mountain on the very path you took up. And so you think, if it's hard going down, what was it going up? The only way you get up is that you do one step at a time, and you stop and take deep breaths as often as necessary. And if you just persevere, eventually you outlast the mountain and you get to the top of it.
I have never attempted in anything like that. I think the the top of my climbing experience is Harney Peak.
The highest point in South. In fact, the highest point east of the Rocky Mountains.
And
yes,
they've renamed that, I think, now.
It's now Black Elk Peak.
Right. Nothing like what you did. But I've read enough about mountaineering that, and I think statistically the facts would bear this out, is that most injuries and fatalities occur on the descent, not the ascent.
Well, for one thing, gravity is now working for you, not against you, and it's pulling you off the mountain. I mean, it's amazing how much sliding you do, because this is not a gradual ascent. You're climbing a huge number of vertical feet in a relatively short distance. I think on the first day, we went 4,500 vertical feet over the space of 6.5 miles. And on the second day, we camped in a really disagreeable place, but the only one available. On the second day, we hiked 2,600 vertical feet in the space of 4.4 miles. And so it's steep. And as you come down, gravity is pulling you, and you tend to go faster than you should because you're in a hurry. You think that the hard part of the journey is over. And I even find this on the annual Lewis and Clark trips, the Wendover Death March. Going down is hard on the knees, it's hard on the joints, it's hard on your feet, and your toes are thrust to the front of your shoes, and they get jammed up there. In fact, I don't want to sound too much like a Facebook post, but I will almost certainly lose the big toenail on my right foot now in the next week, because by the time I got off the mountain, It was just a bloody mass hanging there, and I'm guessing my body's going to throw it away.
And you're still out of breath, I can tell. What about our man Jefferson? Did he? I mean, I know about his famous quote about looking down from the natural bridge. But did he any mountaineering or climbing that you know of?
Jefferson never did anything of the sort. And actually, in my essay today, I'll talk a little bit about that, David. You know, Jefferson was a gentleman. Mountains weren't climbed in his time. When Theodore Roosevelt climbed the Matterhorn, which is even slightly higher than Mount Whitney, on his honeymoon in Europe, he was 22 years old, by the way, but when he climbed it, he was, I think, the 10th or 11th person ever to climb it. I mean, the idea of climbing mountains, which is, you know, we have kind of an Everest or a K2 complex that you climb mountains, and when you're asked why you climb them, you say, because they're there, and somehow there's ego attached to it, and there's a whole world of it that simply intellectually and spiritually did not exist in the age of Jefferson. People looked at mountains and they thought they were impressive and so on. The closest Jefferson ever got was that he crossed the Alps from Italy into France, and he did it in 1787 when he briefly went into Italy, what he called his peak into Elysium. He wanted to go all the way to Rome and Naples, but he couldn't justify it to himself. He was, after all, the American ambassador to France. And he climbed up over this Alpine pass, but he had muleteers and carriages and guides and so on, but still very high. And he was trying to ascertain Hannibal's route during the Carthaginian Wars in the 2nd century B.C., That's as high as he ever got, but one doesn't get the sense that it was the strenuous life in quite the way we're talking about here.
Yeah, I've been reading, as you know, back into Dumas Malone's Sage of Monticello.
Yes, the sixth and final volume of his amazing biography of Jefferson.
It speaks about his trip from Washington back to Monticello and the wagon loads of things. And
oh, yes.
Yeah.
And when he left the presidency in 1890.
The last wagon to leave was, I believe it was horse-drawn, and it was full of shrubbery.
Right. No, that's a perfect example, David, of the gentility of Jefferson's life. So, I mean, let's not romanticize it. When he went to Monticello or Washington, D.C., a distance of about 140 miles, I think he had to go through 8 creeks that didn't have bridges. So you come to the creek, you ride your carriage, your horse down through it and up the other side. It was not comfortable, and he had to sleep in inns that were filled with lice and vermin. People had to share beds in inns. The linens were seldom changed. The food was deplorable. Riding a horse for 8 or 9 or 10 hours a day, even for a great horseman like Jefferson, was a tedious business.
So he would ride.
He rode when he could, and he was in a carriage sometimes, and he walked. He was a great walker. Jefferson walked 4, 5, 6, 7 miles per day at the height of his life. He said that walking is the greatest health thing that exercise that one can get. So he was not afraid of exercise, but he didn't do things that we would call heroic. He didn't do things that we would call Rooseveltian. He was a much more gentleman hiker, and he usually had staff. There was usually a slave or a postillion or a valet or a carriage driver or somebody to look after him, and his role essentially was to be led in as much comfort as was available in the early 19th century from Monticello to Washington, or Monticello to Boston, or from, for that matter, from Paris down to Aix-en-Provence or Marseille.
Well, back to the mountain climbing. So he yes. did not climb, but there is that famous line of his when he went up on the natural bridge,
and he freaked out and had a headache and said he had to get down on his hands and knees, and he nearly fainted. And you know, when I thought about this,
and how high is that?
About a couple hundred feet. But on the other hand, there is no place in climbing Mount McKinley where you have vertigo. There's no place where you think, oh my goodness, I don't want to slip here. Even the narrowest parts of the ascent are along a 3 or 4 foot wide stable rock base.
Well, have you been out on the natural bridge and looked down?
I have been in similar situations, and it is a little freaky, you know, when there's no guardrail. So if you went up to, let's say, an interstate highway bridge and looked down and walked across it, it'd be perfectly fine. Now take the guardrails off. It's a different experience altogether. And the narrower that gets, the more frightened you are. I understand it perfectly. I've been on top of high buildings, and you think, if there were no plexiglass here or guardrails or restraining systems, I'd be terrified. So I get it, but Jefferson never, I think, had an experience of vertigo at a very high height. And part of the famous passage in Notes on Virginia about the natural bridge is, I don't want to sound too negative about this, but there's a certain pose there. He's posturing as a man of the Enlightenment facing the chasm and the abyss before him. Probably his actual experience was less romantic and less sublime than he wants us to believe in reading the famous account that he put in Notes on Virginia.
Well, I like to believe him. As you can tell from the music, sir, we're going to take a short break in just a moment here, but we do have a stack of letters addressed to you, sir.
I'm still alive. That's the whole point. And Russ is too, although he claims that he's hurting also.
When we come back, I have a letter from the UK.
Oh, my.
From Mr. Stuart Webb in Northamptonshire.
All right.
And he has a number of questions for you. It's in response to a show we just did recently, Show Mr. Jefferson, if we could take him out and show him modern things in the world.
Oh, I love that program. Yeah. That was one of my favorites ever.
So we'll take a short break right now, but when we come back, we'll address that letter.
Thank you, sir.
You are listening to The Thomas Jefferson Hour. Welcome back to the Thomas Jefferson Hour, your weekly conversation with or about President Thomas Jefferson. And this week we're answering some listener mail. People have sent in questions to you, Mr. Clay Jenkinson.
Well, it's great to have the correspondence. It's really something that we do this program, and it's touched the lives of a lot of people, and they often sit down and write out a playful or an imaginative or a critical or a helpful suggestion to us. I just love getting the mail.
Me too, and I'm really the luckiest one because I'm the guy who gets to sit here and talk with a dead president multiple times a month.
I used to work with a man named Orville Van Diest in Chautauqua, in the old Chautauqua tents. You know, the modern tent Chautauqua movement was started by Everett Elbers of the North Dakota Humanities Council. We had a huge canvas tent. We took it up and down the Great Plains for 8 or 10 or even 12 weeks per summer, and I worked with this man named Orville Van Diest. I was Jefferson. It was the first time I was Jefferson, and he was A.C. Townley, a Great Plains rabble-rouser.
Right.
And at the end of the week, we would do something called the Meeting of the Minds, which was based loosely on Steve Allen's old show, The Meeting of the Minds, on black and white television. And when I would say something as Jefferson, this guy, Orville, would often say in character, well, that's pretty good coming from a dead president. And I thought, well, that's really such an inappropriate way to go about suspension of disbelief.
But is this a quiet rebuke?
No, you just remind me of this. That's pretty good coming from a dead president.
Yeah, that's A.C. Townley. That's a voice that was unique. People don't know about
he
what
was
a
the
radical state North Dakota was.
Creator of the
time.
Nonpartisan League, which was at one time, North Dakota was taken over by its farmer citizens.
Kind of Jeffersonian, don't you think?
1917 to 1922, and for that period, we were the most socialist place in the Western Hemisphere. We were, in the minds of some historians, a Soviet, and we created a state bank, which still exists, a North Dakota state mill, which still exists, and a state elevator, and we were on our way to creating other state industries, but then it all, of course, like all revolutionary movements, collapsed and fell apart in ignominy, but it was a great moment.
I wonder what Jefferson would have thought of what North Dakota was like during those times.
Well, I don't know. You know, Theodore Roosevelt hated the Nonpartisan League. He went berserk over the Nonpartisan League and wanted them tried for treason, and he could not stand the idea that farmers would rise up in wrath against the interests.
Yeah, but Jefferson would have liked that, wouldn't he?
I think so. Jefferson loves rebellion. Jefferson believes that the people have a right to redress their grievances as peacefully as possible and as forcefully as necessary. And, you know, not to get into a digression here, but the historic problem of the Great Plains, including North Dakota, has been colonialism, that the banks were in Minneapolis and Chicago. The railroads were headquartered somewhere else, and the rates were set arbitrarily. And, of course, we were isolated, so the rates were even more stiff here than they would have been in Ohio or Indiana. And the wheat was milled, was turned to flour in Minneapolis. Minneapolis was the nation's leading flour manufacturer, partly because of St. Anthony Falls, which provided the water power for those mills. It's actually a fascinating story, and many of those mills have been restored now as museums and lofts and sort of boutique hotels and housing in the second decade of the 21st century. But North Dakota was in this colonial status. We would send our cattle somewhere else, and the rates would be set elsewhere. We would send our wheat, and the rates would be set elsewhere, and the grading would be done. People would say, that's not the highest grade. That's grade number 3. You've got some rust in it, or it got wet and then dried, and so on. And so the people of North Dakota felt that we were, I use this term very carefully, serfs or slaves to capitalist entities that existed somewhere else and at the mercy of them, and that they worked hard to exploit us. They weren't trying to be fair. They were trying to do what capitalists do, which is to squeeze as much profit as they possibly can out of the land and its people. And so in 1915, a legislator told the farmers who were lobbying at the state capitol, quote unquote, to go home and slop the hogs. And that precipitated this agrarian revolution led by a demagogue and rabble-rouser by the name of A.C. Townley, and that was the character that my friend Orville Van Deest portrayed in Chautauqua. There's a long digression.
But it was a good one, and it is an interesting period of North Dakota history, well, United States history, really. Back to the letter we discussed before our break comes from Stuart Webb.
Of Britain.
Brigstock, Northamptonshire.
Northamptonshire, yes.
A lot of it I'm going to skip because it would embarrass me to read it. He is so kind in his praise of the show, and we really do appreciate that. He writes to congratulate you on the show, 1255, Show Mr. Jefferson. He says it was such fun. It was almost a Christmas special. It had almost a Christmas special feel to it.
Is that the one where someone wrote and said, what would you show Jefferson if he came into the 21st century?
He also says it would be unfair to single out an individual program, as the show is a constant delight. And thank you for that.
That's amazing, and we so appreciate that.
And he ends that beginning section by praising you, sir, for the Jefferson Watch section. Says he holds great affection for the United States and worries for the nation at the moment. The Jefferson Watch provides me with calm, measured, and reasoned views and opinions that provide the reassurance I currently seek from the USA. I hope you plan to maintain this as a regular item.
Well, you and I were just talking about that before we got to the barn today. We rode out together. And the essay, the Jefferson Watch, takes some time. You know, it's easy enough to wing it, but when you're actually committing yourself to paper, you have to think a little bit. I love doing it. It has been a it's not a burden, but it's a responsibility. And I've wondered what people think. And so this is a good time to ask our listeners if they agree with Stuart and think that the essay is the Jefferson Watch is worth doing. I do think it is, and I take great pride in it. You know, I'm a writer more than I am anything else, and so it gives me a chance every week to step back and reflect out of character, but through Jefferson, about the world that's passing in front of us, David.
Mr. Webb's letter was three parts. Praise, we've gotten that. A suggestion. And his suggestion is that we do a show that explores the world that Jefferson lived in, its views, beliefs, and structures. You have it in front of you, don't you?
Yes.
He goes on, you often comment that Jefferson lived the other side of the Industrial Revolution, Freud and Darwin. You frequently suggest that when considering Jefferson, we should see the whole man. I think it would be interesting and useful to look at his world. To return to show 1255, I suspect a person born in 1469, if transported forward 274 years to Jefferson's birth, would find a changed world, but one that was still quite familiar, whereas he says if they went from Jefferson's time to ours, it would be hardly recognizable.
Stuart, thank you for this letter. It's a brilliant letter, and it shows that you have really listened carefully and that you have absorbed what I think are the main insights about Jefferson. So, I mean, what could be more flattering than somebody who not only says nice things but proves that they have been listening and listening carefully and that their outlook has been shaped by it. So I sometimes say that if Moses or Socrates came to Monticello, they would not be flabbergasted. They would recognize the agricultural practices, and they would recognize the way water is brought to the table and the way beer is made and wine and so on. But if you went from the death of Jefferson in 1826 to, say, 1926, there'd be a world of difference. And if you went from 1926 to 2017, it's astounding revolution. Medicine, communications, transportation, entertainment. Just think of the storage of information, the publication of books, the spread of knowledge, the scientific endeavors in DNA, in the size of the universe, in biotechnology, and so on. We understand the world almost infinitely more intricately than was done in Jefferson's time. He was living in an age when they were still bleeding people when they were ill, or putting leeches on them, or eliminating their digestive tracts with mercury and calomel.
Did Jefferson ever speculate on the future, Clay?
Yes. And here's what he thought. It's just going to get better. Jefferson believed, however much had been achieved in his time, that we were going to continue to march forward. And, you know, this is what I love most about Thomas Jefferson. I know not everyone does. The hard-headed and the Adamsites are always a little hard on this side. But his optimism is what has kept me at it. It's what keeps me alive in some respects. Jefferson said it's just going to get better. Eventually, all the world is going to be America. In other words, all the world is going to have a Bill of Rights. All the world is going to have due process. All the world is going to get rid of despots and tyrants and false aristocrats. He believed that science would march forward, that we would solve most of the problems of life. On the analogy of Newton's principles of gravitation and so on, thermodynamics, Jefferson believed that all social problems would be solved by reason and good sense and science and goodwill. And he believed that humankind would find a way to thrive, and that what we call evil, or what we call antisocial activity, or the dark side, however you want to characterize what goes wrong, you know, child abuse, child pornography, sex trafficking, war, rape, mayhem, naked exploitation of workers, all those things that we call sin or the dark side or evil or whatever we call them, they would disappear. That man is, in Jefferson's mind, essentially good. And if you will just liberate him from all of the things that have constrained and pulverized him in the past, and give that some time. It doesn't happen overnight. You can't be released from your chains and suddenly be thriving. It will take time. But if we liberate humans and educate them and give them the tools of human happiness, that life will turn more beautiful and societies will be more harmonious and problems will be solved and we will create something like paradise on earth if we only maintain our faith in the goodness of man and the capacity of humans to reform the world around them along principles of respect and generosity. I love that, don't you? Now, I don't necessarily believe it. Do you?
I guess, you know, my thought on all of this is, you know, we're in this position right now of knowing more than Jefferson.
Much more.
Because...
About everything.
Because of the time we live in.
Right.
What do you think it's going to be like in 2066?
Well, the thing is, we know more. We know infinitely more. But the question is, John Adams would say, that doesn't change human nature, gentlemen.
What have you done with it?
Right. You know, human nature, says Adams, is a constant, that man is a rascal, and if there were no outside constraining mechanisms, man would be much greater a rascal than he is. So don't be over-optimistic here. Yes, there will be improvements because good nutrition and better distribution of the resources of the world and better education will certainly improve things, but don't think that you're going to get to some sort of a heavenly plateau where life is harmonious and beautiful and good.
I knew you were going to get to Mr. Adams.
I don't like Adams. All I'm saying is that I'm the one who brought this up, that Adams is a necessary counterweight, because Adams would say, what world do you live in, gentlemen?
We had a couple of discussions years ago on the Adams-Jefferson letters, which I could revisit.
I love those. We should revisit them.
But I did find something that Jefferson wrote to Adams in 1816, and he said, I believe that every human mind feels pleasure in doing good to another.
Yes, so that's Jefferson, the student of Lawrence Stern's Tristram Shandy. The age of Jefferson had this movement. It was mostly European, but partly here, which believed that we are capable of exquisite sensitivity, and that if we will just listen and hear what people around us need, that we can help supply those needs of affection, caress, respect, economic aid, sympathy when they're grieving, health when they're wounded, and that the ideal human event is to look around you and see what you can do for others in small ways. They don't necessarily involve your checkbook. They don't really necessarily involve much time. But how can you do little, beautiful things every day for everyone around you? And that, if you do it, this is called Shandyism, after Lawrence Stern's novel Tristram Shandy. If you become a Shandian or a sentimentalist, that you can make life better. And when you make life better for the 17 people you encounter tomorrow, then that has the possibility that they will pay it forward, and they will be a little less grumpy, they'll be a little more happy, a little more serene and comfortable, a little more confident, and they too then will spread the good news of doing what Wordsworth calls little unremembered acts for others that make a big difference, even though they're tiny, in their actual commitment of resources. That's the spirit of Jefferson.
Back to Stuart Webb's letter, he had praise, suggestion, and a question. Well, we've got the praise and the suggestion.
What's the question?
Well, you should take a look at page 2. I believe you have his letter.
I have it right in front of me. Okay, I've got it. As for my question, what was Jefferson's view on who should be trusted with the vote? As part of a recent course I completed, an historical inquiry on British parliamentary reform, 1832 to 1928. From this, I realized that in Jefferson's times, the elections held in Britain were remarkably inconsistent, with things such as size of constituencies and eligibility to vote varying by huge amounts from area to area. I also learned that reform and the subsequent increase in the franchise was always accompanied by significant debate on just who were respectable and responsible enough to be trusted with the vote. So, yes, that's absolutely true. There were rotten boroughs, as they were called in Britain. The representatives to this day don't necessarily have to live in the place that they represent. The number of voters was held to be very small and controlled both by race, gender, and by political affiliation. Some of this continues to this day in Britain, although they've made enormous strides in the last 60 or 70 years.
He goes on to say the American Revolution offered the founding fathers a tabula rasa for electing officials. And I know from listening to the show that Jefferson believed in the common sense of the general population. We were just talking about that. But I suspect that this had its limits. As I understand it, individual states determined their own eligibility criteria for voting, but I imagine Jefferson had his views on this. Did he feel that factors such as being a householder or a certain level of education or income were required to be eligible to vote, or did he consider that the electorate should be as wide as possible amongst the free men in the new country?
Well, how to put this? Jefferson had a very wide and generous view of who should be an elector, who should be able to vote or hold public office. At the same time, David, he was a man of his time, so he didn't think that women should vote or hold public office. He didn't think that free blacks should vote or hold public office. He did believe that all white males should be able to vote, and he said that if others believed that a parcel of property was essential to responsible voting, then we should give every propertyless person 50 acres somewhere in the American West so that all white men instantly became eligible to vote and hold public office. So this was regarded as radical democratic mobocracy in his time. It seems a little constrained to us, particularly on the question of gender and race. But Jefferson believed in something like universal franchise for white males throughout the course of his life.
Who owned property?
No, if they didn't, you gave them property. He thought they shouldn't have to have property, but if you, John Adams, insist that property is essential to this, then let's give them property.
A great letter from Stuart Webb.
And he says, once again, thank you for a cracking show. Very British.
May we thank you, sir, for a cracking letter.
And tell all the Brits, because Jefferson wanted to reform them, David, and here's our chance.
So thank you, Stuart, for listening. And right now we're going to take a short break, then we'll get to some more letters when we return. You're listening to the Thomas Jefferson Hour. Welcome back to the Thomas Jefferson Hour, your weekly conversation with or about President Thomas Jefferson. This week, our conversation is with Mr. Clay Jenkinson, the creator of the Thomas Jefferson Hour. And we've been asking you to answer mail this week because we've got quite a stack. And we spent a lot of time responding to a letter from Stuart from the UK.
Great letter from Stuart.
Yeah. I want to see if we can buzz through a couple of these that we have left in the stack. One from Ted Shiley, and he says, I just finished listening to the Thomas Jefferson 101 about the second term and noted for the first time in my memory, TJ's Republican Party was referred to as the left. Today's left is not equated with the small government that TJ promoted.
He's right. These labels are so porous. So in Jefferson's time, it was Republicans versus Federalists. In our time, it's Democrats versus Republicans, or right versus left, or conservative versus liberal. These terms are always sloppy. There were no political parties in Jefferson's time.
Jeffersonians who were considered Republicans were because they favored a republic.
They favored a small R republic with a Bill of Rights and a set of constraints on the powers of government. And limited government was essential to this. The self-actualization and empowerment of the individual was the heart of that philosophy, and agrarianism was usually at its center economically.
And he goes on in his letter to ask he says, more confusing to me is who the Federalists are. My understanding from listening to the show is that the Federalism of Hamilton and Adams was for central government. On the other hand, the federalism of today, I thought, is for states' rights and the federal government's diminished power, as much as Jefferson would support. And again, federalism during his time?
It's another one of those confusing terms, David. So for Jefferson, the Federalists meant those people who had advocated a strong central government, a strong military.
A strong federal government.
Economic alignment with Great Britain. And that the Federalists, in Hamilton's terms, wanted to swallow up the states and effectively eliminate them as jurisdictional units. The Republicans were more for the states' rights. But he's right that federalism, in our terms, today usually means a balance between the central national government and state and local government. So the Federalist societies are frequently advocating a better balance between state authority and federal authority. So these terms do change, but for Jefferson, federalism was a bad word, and it meant Hamilton.
We thank you for that that letter, Mr. Shiley. I believe he's from Groton, New York.
Indeed.
And then there's one you have in front of you from Carol Prieto.
And she, too, listened to the show, Mr. Jefferson, What Would We Show Him If He Came Back Today?, which is one of those questions put to us by one of our listeners, and it really, for me, created one of my
happiest
shows.
One of your favorites.
Shows.
You love those shows.
I love those shows.
I do, too, yeah.
So she says, well, what would she do? Where would she take Jefferson? She says her views are a little more modest than mine, but here they are. Number one, she'd take him to the National Archives to see such documents as the Declaration of Independence, something called the Charters of Freedom exhibit. All right, fair enough. She says that she would take him to the Library of Congress so he could see Mr. Jefferson's library, which, as you know, has been reconstituted and has a very beautiful and special exhibit space in the Jefferson Building of the Library of Congress. The Jefferson Building of the Library of Congress is one of America's greatest and most beautiful buildings. And number three, she would take Jefferson to Philadelphia to see Independence Hall. And she says, oh, what I would give to hear his memories of the Continental Congress. And finally, four, she would take Thomas Jefferson to Fort Clatsop out on the Oregon coast near Astoria, where he could see the spot where Lewis and Clark camped after crossing the continent. Really enjoyed the episode. Thanks. So let me just say this. I would not take Jefferson to any of those places except the last one, because he already knew about those places. You know, he wrote the Declaration of Independence. He certainly knew about archives. He had been to Carpenter's Hall, the Independence Hall now, as we call it, in Philadelphia, where the Declaration of Independence and the Second Continental Congress were formed. So that was his world that he already knew. I want to take him to places that he didn't know. And so one certainly, and this is a great suggestion by Carol, would be to Fort Clatsop. Jefferson never traveled more than 75 miles west.
That one I wouldn't really even think, because I don't think he would be all that interested. However, I think he would love to see the Pacific Ocean.
Yeah, you'd have to be able to get him there without trouble.
That.
You know, he's not going to get in a horse or hike with Lewis and Clark or row a boat.
Well, Carol Prieto, thanks
for
that.
Well, great, but yeah. I love it when people do this.
And, well, I have another one.
Those are brilliant suggestions. All right.
From Carol Arnold, she speaks to Mr. Jefferson and says, okay, now you've had your grand tour of the United States of America from sea to shining sea. After you rest up, will you ask Mr. Clay Jenkinson and Mr. David Swanson to take you to five places that require rethinking? Have them get your opinions of where we went wrong or how we could have done a better job.
Wow. I've never thought about this before. So it's one thing to take you and me, David, to places where we think we should have done things better, that we need to revisit. I can think of a lot of places, beginning with Wounded Knee in South Dakota, where the Wounded Knee Massacre occurred in the last days of 1890. But that's not the challenge. She's saying, what about taking Mr. Jefferson to places that require rethinking?
Wouldn't he have been, you know, practical. I'm thinking about, I just was reading the other day about him, you know, trying to dig the canal up to, through the river network to Monticello. And I almost wonder if infrastructure issues and things like that wouldn't appeal to him more.
Yes, I agree. He was a pragmatist. And, you know, he said the history teaches us what bad government has been. And so I think he would look on the past and say, look, it's done. There's not much we can do about it. I don't know what I think. We need to do a program about this, and I need to spend some actual time thinking about it. But if you took Jefferson to five places on the North American continent where we should have done it differently, that require rethinking, what would those be? I can tell you one. I think Jefferson would say of New Orleans, this is no place to build a city because it's subject to high tides, flooding, hurricanes. You know, in his own time, Jefferson knew that New Orleans was not a great place to build a city, and now we have a huge one there, and we see from Katrina and from the recent flood and hurricane events in the Caribbean that it is a very vulnerable place. So he would probably want to, as you say, as a pragmatist, take us to places where we should have thought more carefully about how to situate American civilization there, both for its protection against storms and other calamities, but also for the healthfulness of its social climate.
Well, she does end her letter by asking how we can train ourselves to be better thinkers and planners for the future of our country. And that I'm certain Mr. Jefferson could help us with.
You know, never build in a floodplain.
That's a pretty good one.
It's a pretty good one, which we routinely ignore,
and,
of course,
yeah,
in the United
go back
States.
To his first inaugural address, Entanglements with None.
Friendships with all nations, entanglements with none. I think, yes, he was an isolationist. Whether he could be, I mean, this is...
Well, isolationist, but he was really worried about trade.
He was. I think, you know, this question really invites us to think of where Jefferson's baseline principles were and how you translate them into a world that he didn't live to see, which is, in a sense, the very business of the Thomas Jefferson Hour. So, you know, you can be an isolationist in Jefferson's time, but he knew that Americans had a genius for trade, and so he knew that was going to be a set of compromises, that if you have trade, there will be incidents. You need international banking. You need a navy. You need a government strong enough to support all of that. He said, I wish it weren't so. I wish we could be Fortress America, but I see that the American people have a genius for trade. You know, all these things require very careful translation. And so whenever I hear somebody say, well, George Washington would be against this, or Abraham Lincoln would be for that, or Theodore Roosevelt would be for this or that, I always stop because it's almost impossible to really know what these people would think about situations that came to pass after their time. They, after all, were men of contradictions and inconsistencies in their own time, and they didn't live to see the things that we take for granted. I think that the kind of the Tea Party notion that the founding fathers would be against X is something that's a problematic concept, and we need to be much more historically subtle and careful when we make those leaps.
Well, it's always fun to present questions to you from your listeners, sir, and I
so much
enjoy
easier
it.
In character, I must say.
I could understand that.
It's easier to be Jefferson than to be me, and I think it's, you understand that.
But before we go, you've got a couple of things coming up this winter that I wanted to alert listeners to. I know you know your annual gatherings.
Yeah, so you know I did the Shakespeare thing in Norfolk, which was just such a joy, one of the great joys of
great
my life.
Great reviews on that.
And I'm thrilled. Thank you, everyone. And I want to do much more of it. And I want to do it as fundraisers around the country for public radio stations and other nonprofits.
But I'm talking about Loxa Lodge.
Right. But one of the two at Loxa this January, so I think it starts on January 10th, there are two of them. They're 4 days each. And one is on Shakespeare. And there still are a couple of places for that one. You can go to our website, jeffersonhour.com or clayjenkinson.com or odysseytours.net, but you can easily find these. And the other one is on Walden and Desert Solitaire by Edward Abbey. So I do two every year at this fabulous retro lodge just west of Missoula, Montana, in the Bitterroot Mountains at the heart of the Lewis and Clark Trail. And one of them this year is on Shakespeare for 4 days. And the other one is on Walden. It's always on Walden. The idea is that Thoreau asks us all the right Jeffersonian questions about where we live and what we live for and what we value and how much of our life we're willing to contribute to all of that. And so we do these two. You can go to the tour. And then the Steinbeck trip is in March, the second annual John Steinbeck trip of Monterey and surrounding country in California. And then, of course, the Lewis and Clark trip next summer and so on. So people should just go to our websites and they can learn about
these. They can find all the information about all of those events at the website. And thank you.
JeffersonHour.com.
JeffersonHour.com, correct. And thank you for a wonderful discussion this week, which sadly has to come to a close because now, sir, it is time for this week's Jefferson Watch.
Thank you, David. You probably know the cliche. How do you climb Mount Fuji? One step at a time. How do you climb Mount Whitney? One foot in front of the other for about 12 straight hours. I first fell in love with the Sierra Nevada mountains in the 1980s when I drove up from Los Angeles, where I was working, to see the Owens River Project. I had read an account of how L.A. and William Mulholland stole the water of the Owens Valley to feed L.A.'s insatiable thirsts, and I wanted to see the infrastructure for myself. My philosopher friend Donald Rutherford and I made the journey together in my Honda Prelude. We didn't do much climbing, but we were both overwhelmed by the beauty of the foothills at Lone Pine, the otherworldly isolation of Mono Lake, and the realization, I was then 24, that there are whole portions of the planet that are so stark and so forbidding that humans essentially shy away from them. The Sierra Nevada mountains tower over the valley below with stunning magnificence. The dramatic effect is much greater than on the Front Range of the Rockies in Colorado or Wyoming. I followed the Owens Project from its intake all along the Los Angeles Aqueduct to the San Fernando Valley, and I have been fascinated and repelled by gigantic industrial water projects ever since. I've wanted to climb Mount Whitney for 20 years or more, but it has never happened because life kept getting in the way, and I didn't ever want to do it alone, and not that many people are willing to entertain the thought of climbing straight up for 11 miles. When I mentioned the possibility to my friend Russ of North Carolina last year, he did not reject the idea out of hand like everyone else. So we entered the lottery and got assigned October 10th and 11th, 2017. Russ flew in a day or two earlier from Carolina. I flew to Reno from Bismarck, rented a car, bought provisions, and drove down the eastern base of the Sierra to our embarkation point. My pack was 15 pounds too heavy. So was I. But I had one great advantage. I have learned long ago that it is not your body that is the issue in these strenuous adventures, but your soul. So if you really want to do it, no matter how ill-prepared you are, you can succeed if your heart and mind are right. You will remember that Thomas Jefferson climbed to the top of the pitiful little natural bridge in Western Virginia and said, quote, "Few men have resolution to walk to the parapet of fixed rocks and look over into the abyss." He said that he involuntarily had to get down on his hands and feet and, I'm quoting, "looking down from this height about a minute gave me a violent headache." Wow, Mr. Jefferson, there's your strenuous life. Try the headache you get at 14,500 feet. Try looking down a sheer cliff face 2,000 or 3,000 feet to a ledge at the lip of which the next precipitous drop is 2,000 or 3,000 feet. I thought of Mr. Jefferson as we labored up along the creek and the alpine lakes, as we performed the 99 switchbacks of the most vertical ascent of Mount Whitney, and as we passed the tree line into a moonscape of glacial moraine. He'd have had someone already at the top of the mountain with fine cheese and Bordeaux wine. Ascending Mount Whitney was in many respects more in the tradition of Theodore Roosevelt than Thomas Jefferson. Roosevelt famously climbed the Matterhorn on his honeymoon in 1881. The Matterhorn is 14,692 feet high. That's 187 feet higher than Mount Whitney. Roosevelt was 22 years old. I was 62, but now a week later, I only feel about 114 or so. The view from the top of the Sierra Nevada is so spectacular that it beggars the English language. That's what Jefferson meant when he said, "It is impossible for the emotions arising from the sublime to be felt beyond what they are here." Indeed, we summited as the professionals say, about 1 p.m. on Wednesday, October 11th. We would have high-fived if we could have lifted our arms above our heads at that point. We kissed the ground, took a selfie, and began the long, almost endless return to the parking lot. Going down, you begin to get a sense of how much pure climbing it took to get to the top of the mountain, and you have a long time to reflect on the status of your life, physical and mental fitness, what you really still want to accomplish, how you define yourself as a man, a human, a citizen, a lover of existence, and where you really stand on the spectrum of the active versus the contemplative life. It was absolutely worth it, I can tell you that. I would do it again, though I would not do it again without significant training. I will surely lose my right big toenail in the next week. I've been there before. I lost a fair amount of dignity, of course, and some illusions about myself, and some sense of myself as an eternal youth. Fortunately, there were no hospitals to check into when we got to the base, so we had to gut it out, and now a week later, the memories are all sweet and deeply satisfying. I fell in love with California all over again. I fell in love with America's broad reach and magnificence, and I realized that I must never say no to life-affirming opportunities. That is the road to the Barca Lounger, the bag of Cheetos, and a Hogan's Hero Marathon. I'm Clay Jenkinson. We'll see you next week for another exciting edition of the Thomas Jefferson Hour.
The Thomas Jefferson Hour is brought to you each week by Dakota Sky Education. The program is distributed nationally by Prairie Public Radio. President Thomas Jefferson lived from 1743 to 1826, and this program presents his views. President Jefferson is portrayed by the award-winning humanities scholar and author, Clay S. Jenkinson. To obtain a copy of this or any past show for a $12 donation, please call 888-828-2853. Again, that number is 888-828-2853. This program is also available online at jeffersonhour.org and on iTunes. If you'd like to correspond with President Jefferson or submit a question for him to answer on the program, please visit the website at jeffersonhour.org. The Thomas Jefferson Hour is produced at Mokoche Recording Studios in Bismarck, North Dakota. Music by Stephen Swinford. Thank you for listening. Please tune in again next week for another thought-provoking, historically accurate program through the eyes of Thomas Jefferson.